Welcome to Week to Week, the Political Roundtable program from the Commonwealth Club of California. From Monday, December 15th, 2014. I'm going to get my years mixed up. They're going to change soon enough. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. On tonight's program, we will look at how some of the Bay Area's big tech spenders do or do not have the holiday spirit. We'll talk about Obama's budget battle and his other tussles with the congressional GOP and even within his own party. Continuing Bay Area protests over the Ferguson and Eric Garner issues. Dianne Feinstein and that CIA torture report everyone is talking about. Yeah, sorry. And we'll do some reviewing and previewing of the year in politics. So, as usual, any opinions that are expressed up here are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now, actually, speaking of the speakers, if some of you saw that we had Bill Whalen on our program tonight from the Hoover Institution, he had to cancel at the last moment. But Hoover fans, don't worry, because Bill will be back here with his colleagues on our next Week to Week on January 14th. We're going to be having a special edition featuring the exclusive unveiling of a California voter survey, and we'll find out if people across the state think the same as Governor Jerry Brown thinks about the state and about what you think about the state. We'll see if everyone's on the same plane or not. So let's meet our panelists. I'm going to start on the far end there with Joe Garofoli. I get points for pronouncing it correctly. He's a political reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, and next to him is Melissa Griffin Kane, a contributor to CBS SF with Mornings with Melissa and San Francisco Magazine, as well as being an attorney. And next to me is C.W. Nevius, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. You can follow each of them on Twitter. Now, please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit questions. I will do my best to get as many of them asked as possible during this program. Now, on to our roundtable program. For the first topic, well, let's start with the good news. I mean, there are some companies in the Bay Area, some tech companies, which have been the target of quite a bit of criticism and angst, who have been stepping up. And I'm going to start with Joe, because Joe, you recently reported about this, what's called the Pledge 1% program that's been gaining some new adherence. So tell us about it.
Salesforce.com, big player in town, big tech player in town, and they contribute 1% of their, I always have to look down at it, 1% of their equity, 1% of their employees' time, and 1% of the firm's products to charitable good every year. Now, yes, it's nice, isn't it? So now they've been doing this for 15 years, and now there's a move to get smaller companies. Salesforce is worth, you know, gazillions of dollars, but there's a move to get smaller companies to do this, and even startups. The challenge with startups is, you know, they're so busy about survival and making money and whether they're going to make their payroll that they don't really think about philanthropy. So this move is trying to get smaller companies and medium-sized startups to do the same sort of program. And it's sort of, so it sort of bakes in philanthropy into your business plan. Of course, since this is business, there's also a business side to it. Because when you give away, a lot of the tech companies, they give away their product. And when they give away their product, they're kind of seeding new markets. You know, if you're giving away your product they'll typically give away their product to nonprofits. The nonprofits use the product, and they gain new customers, and it becomes more widespread use. So it is a way, there is a business aspect to their philanthropy. But that is something that's been going on now, and that's kind of a good story, right? Yeah. Fa-la-la-la-la.
I mean, they came into San Francisco, and they took a lot of abuse. What are you contributing in San Francisco? And there were a few very poorly placed. You remember the guy had the rant about how lucky the homeless are to live in San Francisco, and they should be fortunate and thank us for having the opportunity. So they didn't quite know what to do. So then they got the idea they had to do something, but they weren't sure what it was. And I remember one of the apps that they came up with was an app that would track the shelter beds, and you'd be able to tell which shelters had available beds, which sounds great, except that your average demographic of your person on the street is probably not going to download the app to the phone he doesn't have, you know. So it was a good idea, and you know, their heart was in the right place, but they needed to have a little help with this. And what, you know, what Joe's pointing out, I think that's a little more like it.
Anything that anchors them to the community is a good thing, right? I mean, one of the fears about having technology be your bread and butter is that they could maybe go somewhere else. You know, there's all sorts of threats that they can make. So, you know, to the extent that they can actually make inroads and start to have a conversation with the communities and be seen as helping and sort of really putting down roots and anchoring themselves, you know, of course, that's a really good thing.
And the kickback from the activists and the people, you know, who are advocating for, you know, more housing and stuff, it's like, well, you know, okay, so you give away your product. I have no idea what your product does. Why don't you give us some money to build affordable housing, for a housing trust, and those ideas have been kicked around. And, you know, their answers are invariably, well, that, you know, that's not our expertise. These are engineers. They're like, we don't know anything about building housing. We don't know anything to do this. We know how to build this app. We know how to, you know, do this type of technology, so we'll give you that. So there is still a disconnect. You know, they're trying to reach out and connecting, but it's getting there, but it's not quite a connect yet.
There are some, though, that I think have stepped up even on the money level. I mean, Google recently donated a total of $2 million to three San Francisco organizations that help homeless people, the Hamilton Family Center, Larkin Street Youth Services, and Hand Up. It also gave $1.5 million to, I believe, a local food shelter. So they weren't just saying, hey, here's a free Google app email account, which is free anyway. Yeah,
and we should say that Benioff and Salesforce really set the standard. And he's done a great job all the way through with very thoughtful, mindful things. They're about to open the hospital down in Mission Bay, and that's going to be amazing. That's a great idea. That's a great example of how to use a considerable amount of money to a good point. And I think that brought a lot of people along. I mean, obviously, this group copied.
And he's a San Franciscan, too. He gets it. He's truly invested in the community because he's, you know, he's one of us.
Well, when Warren Hellman passed away, there seemed to be this vacuum, and people said, we don't know if this new generation of entrepreneurs is going to invest in the community the way that he did. And so Benioff definitely seems to be the person stepping into that role, at least to some degree, in addition to some other people.
And he's taking banjo lessons. I don't know if you knew that.
Well,
I may have made that up.
Well, there, of course, is a political aspect to all this as well, and that is, you know, well, we have a mayoral election here in San Francisco this year. And I think current polls have been showing Mayor Lee probably set for a fairly easy re-election. But it's been considered that his Achilles heel has been his over-identification for some people with the tech industries and the, you know, the so-called Twitter tax breaks and things like that. So it certainly behooves him to get these companies visibly engaged in the city, people visibly seeing Twitter working with Embarcadero YMCA, for example, on their school initiatives and things like that. I mean, if you were a Lee confidant, a Ron Conway, or a Rose Pack, I mean, wouldn't you be kind of saying, issue some more press releases, go do a press conference over at Twitter?
Oh, they're issuing press releases. I can promise you that we get them every day. But you know, you've got a non-controversial, kind of boring mayor in the middle of an economic boom. It's pretty hard to beat that, you know, to be honest. That's not a bad model for a politician. And I'm sure that's what Mark Leno did, as he looked at that and said, this is going to be an uphill fight. And as Rose Pack said, I'm sure he'd have a lot of fun if he ran, but he's not going to win.
Well, let's stop talking about companies that are doing good stuff. Let's talk about the poster child, perhaps, of companies that are trying to prove you don't... Well, this is going to sound overly mean.
Come on, John.
I'm just going to start with this one little factoid. So you all heard or saw the news about this hostage situation in Sydney, Australia today. And if any of you have friends who are in Sydney, downtown Sydney, Australia, during this hostage situation and they needed to get out of there by like trying to catch a Uber ride, Uber quadrupled its prices during this hostage situation. They actually sent out a message saying, with an exclamation point, demand is off the charts.
Who knew? All these people fleeing a gunman. Why would they, you know?
Yeah. Now, Uber did, after the inevitable outcry, rescind that and said they would reinstate or repay the folks who had paid these inflated prices. But talk about a tin ear.
Yeah. I think Melissa earlier, when we were sitting in the office, said it really well. I love Uber, but they're not making it easy. You know, it's just...
I love them, like, despite themselves. Like, just stop. Just shut up. It's like, just stop trying to go after journalists and stop doing ridiculous things. Like, don't get me wrong. Surge pricing, I'm not even that terribly against. I know when, like, the other day when it was raining and terrible outside and I was just being a punk and didn't want to wait. I was like, all right, fine. I'll pay my surge pricing. But the terrorist situation is just beyond the pale. Like, that is... there's a typhoon coming. Off the charts, you know? No. You don't get to smiley face emoticon that Uber. So, yeah, but I use them all the time. I admit, and I, you know, maybe after today's discussion, I will be mysteriously cut off from the service. But I do love them, but they do make it difficult. And this, you know, Emil Michael, the senior vice president, who's just a constant mess, you know, really, I mean, who's awesome and who I should not cut off my Uber service, who, you know, it's just like they just need like some sensitivity training over there or something. It's just, they're so, and I know that they're expanding and they're worth billions, but they, somewhere along the way, like they neglected like an HR department in that incredible trajectory. And I think, Chuck, you were writing about this issue of the Sydney surge pricing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that they do, and they do this consistently, is their first reaction when the prices go through the roof and people say, holy crap, I took this ride, you know, a week ago and it was $10, now it's $35. And they explain to you very slowly and carefully so you'll get it. This is actually a good thing for you because as the prices go up, then more drivers will be available. And they have said that so many times that when this hostage crisis happened in Sydney, that was their first reaction was, all of you who are trying to get out of the hostage situation so you don't get shot, this is actually a good thing because now there'll be more. And they eventually, finally, somebody, you know, hit them over the head and said, and they said, what we meant to say is all the rides will be free. That's what we were trying to say earlier. And we'll reimburse the people who paid four times the usual rate trying to flee a gunman. You know, it's just...
thing for our investors.
Yeah.
They also did... Melissa, tell us about the police chief issue.
This is so fascinating. I don't know how many of you guys have read about this, but if you haven't, you really must, because it's just... I cannot even begin to do it justice. Again, Mr. Michael, who rents a $13,000 a month apartment... with a hot tub, and we know all sorts of details about this man's living space now. So at one point, he reports to his landlord that I've got my hot tub is broken, or like there's some like issue in his fabulous $13,000 a month apartment, and the landlord like sends in a handyman to fix the problem, and he declares that the landlord has violated his personal space, he's violated the lease, he's trespassed, he brings a case in court. Now, and the judge throws it out. And I don't know how many lawyers are in here. I suspect a lot, because you guys are a pretty smart crew. So, yeah, there's like one every three people. But to get your case tossed out for just being too silly to even be dealt with is really rare. I mean, judges will pretty much entertain a lot of nonsense, especially here. So San Francisco judges, I think, like have a higher tolerance. And the judge...
Attorney speaking.
Yeah, no, I can tell you from experience, like, it's crazy. So the judge actually threw it out and was basically like, this is a landlord-tenant issue, this is frivolous. And he said, by the way, legally speaking, if something's frivolous, you can actually then sue for your attorney's fees. So, I mean, it's a big deal to call the F word in the courts in San Francisco. So he says that this is borderline frivolous, throws it out, and in the midst of all this, of course, in the midst of filing all the claims in court, all these emails come out, and these emails between him and his landlord. And in the emails, they're just terrible, terrible. They're what you think they are. They're just so entitled, so just inflammatory. I've suffered emotional distress because you sent a handyman to fix that thing I complained about. And then in the midst of it, he says, I play poker with the chief of police, Greg Sir, and I will call him. And so, of course, this comes out, and of course, they go to police chief Greg Sir, and he comes, and he was like, "I am not his friend." He was like, "I met him once; he seems decent, but like, we are not pals." It was just so horrible, and just again, sort of all of this. You don't want to stereotype tech people. You don't want to stereotype people in startups. But it's hard when they just keep doing these things that make them like cartoons that need to be on TV shows and not in real life. And it's going on, by the way. It's still ongoing. He's still in the apartment. He still has claims of emotional distress against his landlord. But it was one of these things. This is the same guy who said we should invest $1 million to investigate and, you know, come up with op research on journalists. So this is the same dude, right? Again, still a senior vice president. No chance of any demotion or, you know, exhaustion leave, something to get this person out who's just this like human gaffe machine. And he won't, and they keep him on, and it makes it difficult to defend a company that sort of continues to pay someone. We don't know how much he makes, but it's enough to have a $13,000 a month lease, which I don't know if any of us made mistakes like he's been making, you know, if we would still be in a position to do that thing. So, again, if you haven't read them, please Google it. It's fabulous.
One of the things we were talking about in the newsroom is that the new dynamic for a lot of the startups is instead of taking a 10-year plan and sitting down and having a think group to plan out your strategy for business, their idea is just get started. And if you run into a roadblock, like Uber did with not having enough insurance, or they've been sued now for not background checking the drivers, we'll deal with that when it happens. So that's kind of the mindset, and that's what you're seeing. They've been sued in Portland, they've been sued here, but they're in 250 cities around the world. They're worth $41 billion now, and they're 4 years old.
And that's the reason that there has been no discipline in this guy is because this company is doing well. And that's the cynical, the darkly, very disturbing bottom line here is the bottom line. They're doing well, so this guy stays there. There's you don't see a lot of investors, Uber investors, going like, yeah, this is really disturbing. You guys should really stop it, but keep making money. And in the meantime,
I thought he was a friend of Greg Sears. I really get that.
You've all heard the story also about the environment at Zillow, the online house listing place where they're facing all kinds of accusations of sexual harassment and such. So. And I don't know what their market cap is, but I think it's pretty good. So they're not going to be facing, they'll just be facing the lawsuits, not any pressure from people. So, Chuck, I'm going to go to you to give us a nice outro for this. And that is, you recently wrote about the Tenderloin's St. Anthony Dining Room. This is the local group that's doing something good. They're not a tech company, but this is like traditional goodness. Give us the feel good. What do they do?
Well, you know, they have the new building, and it's beautiful, but the dining room is really remarkable. And, of course, when we had this terrible, terrible rainstorm, which we hyped like the second coming of... oh, my God, storm again. We have a Hearst Fellow, a woman who, if you're a Hearst Fellow, you spend 9 months going to several of the Hearst newspapers, and she's at the Chronicle now. She's from Minnesota, and she was like, explain this to me again. It's raining, and you're canceling school. We have 2 feet of snow, and they say get on out there. You know, it's just like, what's the deal? So anyway, we had made a big deal. We knew it was going to be a problem. And I think a lot of us had the same thought when that rain began pounding down on the roof is, what about those people we see every day on the streets that are sleeping on the street? And what St. Anthony's did is they found another charity that was putting together a shelter but hadn't gotten it together yet. They got 80 mattresses. They opened their dining room. They brought people off the street into there. They fed them breakfast the next morning. And there were people, just like the woman that I talked to, visiting from, she's actually from Liverpool originally, but she was visiting San Francisco, and she heard the rain and walked outside, and the power went off in the financial district. And she said, my God, what are those people going to do? And she got out her little cell phone and called 4 different charities, and St. Anthony's was the only one that picked up, and they said, come on down. 2 hours later, she was handing trays of food to homeless people, and it just was a lovely San Francisco moment. It really was. Thank
you. We're going to ruin that nice moment by talking about the Congress and President Obama's attempts to deal with them. We have not even installed this new Congress that was created by last month's elections, but we have had what many are seeing as kind of the pre-launch, the soft launch, if you will, of that relationship with this recent spending bill, the government funding bill. So earlier this month, Congress, of course, rushed to pass a $1.1 trillion spending bill. People on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party started fighting against it pretty strongly. Nancy Pelosi went against it, and usually it's her job to just kind of rally her troops to kind of swallow their pride and vote it through. But apparently the White House rallied around. Has this created, Joe, has this created...
Well, when you hear Nancy Pelosi saying, this is the first time I've ever heard her say, I am disappointed in the White House. She did not use the air quotes. She said, I'm disappointed in the White House. No air quotes. That is extraordinary because Obama, through all any misstep he might have done, I think the president has the right idea at heart. And she's like your most loyal friend. But for her to turn on him on this, she's like, what? She essentially accused him of selling out. And that's huge coming from her because when you lose Pelosi, that's got to be Obama's best friend in Washington. And one of a dwindling number of friends. And so when you lose her, that's saying something.
What do you think this augurs for when we hit January, we see a whole new Congress, but the enlarged GOP majority in the House, the Senate now going to be led by the Republicans. Do you have any sense of how the Democrats, the White House and congressional Democrats are going to... deal with this?
I almost don't think it's the end of the world. I think it's an opportunity for them to say to the Republicans, all right, let's see you guys do something. And by the way, we're going to fight you every step of the way. So see how you like that, just like you've been doing to us. And they got a few things out of it. They got the consideration for a lot of those appointments because of that. Ted Cruz stepped up and stepped on his coat. He called for another vote, which a lot of people opposed, and even people in his own party. There's a very good chance that Republic. It's a very fractured group. I'm not sure it's completely the worst news ever. Although you don't want to lose Pelosi. You're right.
And it'll be interesting because you figure they have about 10 months to get anything done, and then everyone's going to be in full fledged running for president mode. There's a short amount of time to get anything done. You'd like to think everyone's talking about, well, that's our incentive, the Republicans' incentive to. Prove that we can come up with something and not just be oppositionalists. Is that a word? Right, it is now. And so we'll see. We'll see what happens. I think you're going to see a lot of Democrats going, hey, don't do that. A lot of like that, because they're going to be powerless to do anything. They're going to be the minority in both houses. They're not going to have a lot to say, and it's going to be, for people who live here, a sad time.
One of the audience members asks or says, Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, is who Democrats and progressives, yes, there is a difference, thought Obama was. Do you think she has a shot at the presidency in 2016?
Well, that speech was awesome.
Yeah.
That was really something. She gave a speech about the financial bailout and just really lectured everyone, including the president, again. And... it's always a good sign, I think, when you finish a speech like that and they say, gee, you're a little tough there. That's a good sign for somebody who wants to be a leader. She really, really stepped up. And I think that's going to be one of those moments when you saw someone step into the national spotlight. She's obviously been there. She's been under the radar a little bit. But that was a moment when I think a lot of people across the country said, who is this again? I'm interested in her.
I don't think she has much of a chance in 2016, mostly because she's not going to run in 2016. So that, can be a problem. But even if she did, what we saw is, the wing of the Democrats that she was able to get to, for example, even in California, 12 of California Democrats voted for this bill. So, she clearly is not capturing at this point enough of the party to really make it a big challenge. What we're going to see more and more is sort of the progressive wing and the sort of the Tea Party wing making nice to block what is now going to be like a big moderate blob of Democrats and Republicans who are going to be working together, because I don't necessarily think that the Democrats are going to stop the Republicans every step of the way. I think, if anything, this bill shows that there are enough moderate Democrats to help whatever, you know, is in the middle for Republicans get some things done. And it might be, you know, distasteful, it might be incremental, but if this budget means anything, it means that Democrats, especially once now, that, you know, at the prospect of more Republican control, are getting in touch with their inner moderates. And sort of, you know, go, well, we have to because we have to. And sort of voting this way in a way that they might already want to. But at any rate, I think we're going to see more of that cooperation again by the sort of the edges of the party. And Elizabeth Warren, as much as we love her, she's just, A, she's not going to run. And then B, she doesn't have enough control over enough of the, you know, progressive versus Democrat group to make a big challenge.
She can still play a vital role, yeah, though, in being sort of the conscience, Hillary Clinton's liberal conscience, because she will, you know, even if she doesn't run, she will still be commenting on things, and she can, for folks who care about this, pull Hillary a little bit more to the left, to the Democrat wing of the Democrat Party, as Howard Dean famously said. But no, she doesn't have the money I mean, she's not running, but it would be hard to run against Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's why nobody is right now.
I would say that they also had the specter of the government shutdown when they vote for the budget thing. So that might have swung a little bit. Nobody wants to see that again. That didn't work. That didn't work for anybody. So that was probably in the back of their minds.
Obama's issues are not just going to be in dealing with the Congress of both parties. Melissa, you recently on CBS SF were talking about governors that are suing him over his immigration stance. Yeah, do you want to talk a bit
more
about
lawyers.
That?
And
how is he?
So I think the last count, it was 20. It was, but it keeps growing. These states are coming on board with this lawsuit. And look, this is a different lawsuit than the other one that you might have heard of, where John Boehner has, you know, threatened and did file a lawsuit against the president because of what the president did on Obamacare, the delaying of the small business inclusion on Obamacare. This is different. This is governors suing him, saying he is not upholding his part of the Constitution by issuing his immigration executive order. Right? So what they say is the Constitution says you have to enforce the laws of Congress, right? That's what you have to do according to the Constitution, and that you're not, because there are laws that Congress has already passed that say if you are not a resident and you have a child who is a citizen, then you have to go back to your home country for 10 years and wait, and then you might become eligible to get a visa to come back to the United States. That's the process we use presently for parents of legal citizens. That's what Congress has already said. And they said the president's plan of, if you have a child who is a citizen, who's legal, and you have been here for 5 years, then we're going to defer your deportation. Those two things are incompatible. And that thing that Congress passed, that's the law that the president is supposed to be upholding. And the fact that he doesn't is a problem. Now, we always run into, whenever we have these like president lawsuits, we always run into like, where's the harm, right? Because you can't sue without having incurred some kind of harm, like the Uber executive's severe emotional hot tub distress. Like you have to show you've been hurt. And so these governors, like their claim that they've been hurt is they say that once this executive order gets out and people in these other countries hear about it, even though they're not eligible for it, you know the way gossip works, that the way the DREAM Act, for example, brought a lot of Central Americans to our borders, this is going to do the same thing. This is going to bring, the floodgates are going to open, and everyone's going to think that, even though it's not true, they're going to think that they can come here, and that's going to be a strain on our social services. That is the lawsuit. It has been filed in a federal court in Texas, which might be a pretty friendly place to file such a lawsuit. And so the first order of business the judge has to decide is whether, you know, so we're going to litigate this thing. It's going to take forever like they do. The first order of business is, does the executive order, is that put on hold while this gets litigated? Or does that get to go into effect and then we just kind of litigate it and we'll try to unwind it if we decide against it? So that's sort of the first thing that's on the books. Of course, the Obama administration did extensive legal research before they issued their order. They think they're on really good footing and say, the Congress has evidenced an intent to keep families together. So that's what we're trying to do. But that's the big fight. But it's clear to me that, number one, you know, to show harm, you needed the governors. Number two, John Boehner did not want to touch any more lawsuits. He got so beat up. even by like conservatives were making so much fun of him for that, for the Obamacare lawsuit. It's clear that he didn't want to touch any more lawsuits, so he kind of gave this thing over to the attorneys general of these other states. But that's one thing to look out for, one front that's where part of this fight is happening. And look, a judge could order that the whole executive order be put on hold. I mean, it's not a small or insignificant thing that he could that the judge could do.
You said this and I missed it, but are these just Republican governors, Republican-led states that are suing, or is there a mix of parties?
I think there are two Democrats, but they're really super moderate Democrats. It's not or right-wing Democrats. I don't know. Two Democrats who have joined the lawsuit. It's mostly, but it's weird because there's like the governor of Maine. Like, really, your borders are in trouble? I'm not sure. That's going to be a...
Once the Canadians start coming in.
That's a tough sell. So it's a little more difficult as you go north. But it's mostly East Coast, to be frank. I mean, it's like Louisiana and like Virginia and again, all the way up to Maine. It's mostly sort of Atlantic states that are involved in this. But again, they keep growing, and now I think Arizona's in it, New Mexico's in it. But there's, you know, it's a third of the states. I mean, that's not...
Well, and a couple of things. One is... During the Obama administration, illegal immigration has actually gone down. And for all the talk about the border has actually decreased in terms of illegal immigration. And second, Obama's favorable ratings among Hispanic voters, which we're going to need if he's going to do well in the next election, went up almost 20 points. And as somebody pointed out, even after they shot Osama bin Laden, he didn't go up 20 points. So it's not a lose-lose. It could be if the Texas judge comes around a different way, but in a lot of ways, this is a pretty logical, calculated gamble for somebody who doesn't have a lot of options.
Taking that to 2016, it will become sort of a litmus test for all the candidates on the conservatives and for Hillary Clinton. Is she going to continue to endorse or follow this executive order? She tweeted out right afterwards. She said, "You know, way to go. I'm with you on this." But, you know, we'll see what happens during the primaries.
Well, a few questions before we move on to the next topic. The first one, I know this is a burning question everyone has. Is Melissa Griffin Kane related to Herb Kane?
Well, my husband, Christopher, is right there. Christopher Kane is the son of Herb Kane. So he's my father-in-law. Yeah. The dashing man in the second row right there.
Question, is Chuck related? No.
Yes. I cleared that up, John. That's not true.
We were talking about the budget bill that was passed, the funding for the federal government, and it included a couple things that upset folks on the left. One was what they saw as weakening of the bank regulations, post-crash regulations, as well as some campaign finance issues. And someone asked, what do you predict will be the impact of the bank deregulation legislation? Has anyone looked into, I mean, are these serious things, or do the White House kind of figure these are things we can ameliorate? And
well, the problem is that, so the Dodd-Frank, the part of the bill that got changed was initially there was a set of derivatives that you had to sort of separate from the stuff that is federally insured. The idea being that if this falls, we don't have to insure that. Having said that, the banks are so big that, you know, if the banks are still too big to fail, then you're gonna bail them out anyway. I mean, it's trying to make this sort of separation between stuff that we don't want to insure and stuff that we do is kind of silly in light of the fact that the banks are just very large, and they kind of know that, and we all kind of know, and I think maybe the Obama administration knows, like, we're not gonna let you totally go bankrupt. Bank of America, Citibank, you know, Chase, those kinds. So the impact of that, the calculus is, and who knows if this is going to be true, but the calculus is that it's not going to be a big deal because we were going to do it anyway if they got themselves in trouble. So this actually does, you know, destroying this sort of, you know, Chinese wall isn't that big of a deal.
Someone writes, and I hadn't seen this, but Obama's Surgeon General nominee just got confirmed today. Is that true? Okay. Now, a controversial anti-gun tweet had held up his vote. The person asks, does the Surgeon General have a place in the gun violence debate, or should it be more of a criminal justice issue? Any thoughts on whether this was just...
I think everyone should have a voice in the gun violence debate. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's just...
I don't understand how in this country we continue to ignore that problem. And in the anniversary of Sandy Hook, it just comes back again. It's just to see those people get up and read those names and ring that bell, and with all the emotion and thought and enthusiasm for doing something about that, and really nothing has happened.
One big victory that the NRA has been able to achieve historically, I think it was in the 80s, they did pass a bill as saying that the Surgeon General is not allowed to do any research about gun violence. It was a complete separation. Like you may not go into this area of public health. And so I think the concern is that by appointing someone to the position who sees it as an issue, that, you know, you're sort of breaking down what I think they regard as a big victory for their side of the debate, and that we might be going down that road of allowing the Surgeon General to sort of address that issue. But there is a law that's on the books that they're very happy with, and they don't want to monkey with that.
I want to move on to the next topic, and that is something that any of you... Well, actually, if any of you, like me, get the... I guess they're sent as text messages about traffic issues here or there, or, you know, a police action at this BART station, take another route, you might have been surprised to get one, or at least I was surprised over the weekend to get one, that the police were dealing with a protest at such-and-such street, and shoppers should route around to another way. I mean, what I'm getting at is, you know, Oakland and to probably a lesser extent San Francisco has been experiencing a lot of protests. This is all in the wake of the grand jury decisions not to indict white police officers in the shooting of African Americans, Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner wasn't shot. Of course, he was strangled. Yeah, in New York. These protests have shut down some streets in San Francisco. They have closed some East Bay freeways briefly, and they have at times even turned violent. So I wanted to talk a bit about the politics and the policies of protest, calls for change, and enforcing public order and preventing violence. I know the Chronicle's been reporting on a lot of this.
We've been writing about this, and one of the problems has been the same problem since I started writing about the anti-war protests a dozen years ago, where you have this peaceful demonstration, and then that, you know, goes all around okay, and then at the end there's a bunch of folks wearing masks or wearing bandanas or whatever, disguising their things, and they'll go around breaking windows and playing cat and mouse with the police, and just running around and doing vandalism and increasingly getting involved in physical altercations with people, which is new. What that does is that it, and of course the TV news, that's what they show. And of course, and we do too. We have pictures of broken windows and stuff like that. Well, that was, 5% of what went on in the evening, not 90%. The message is often lost. And that's, and that's too bad for the movement because they don't broaden the movement. Would anyone here want to go join a movement that's like, oh my God, it looks pretty violent? Well, 5% of it was. We had a really interesting story in the paper the other day about the African American. A lot of African American folks are reluctant to join the Ferguson-related demonstrations because of this, and because most of those anarchists are white folks, are white kids. My theory is that they're all trust funders, and they don't get enough thrills in their life, so they have to do this. So as a result, you have, again, a narrowing of this movement. Even people who may feel very passionately about it are afraid to go out there because, ironically, it's white people who are predominantly white people who are making this violence, and they're concerned that the police will blame them. And it's incredibly sad on that level. But the movement at this point has to broaden beyond street demonstrations. That's a great first step. You call attention to the problem. Now what?
And I think we had I think it was that story, but we quoted somebody else the other day that, in a lot of the earlier protests and demonstrations, the desegregation and so forth, there was a goal, and the goal was to get such and such done. And if the goal here is to have a dialogue on race, we've had a dialogue on race. But it's incredible. I mean, I don't know what happened in Ferguson, but that guy getting choked to death, how in the world could that not be an indictment? That just seems impossible. But we have reached the point, and honestly, our reporters, and we're sending some
some young reporters out there to cover these riots, and we've already had a photographer hit. We've had a photographer's camera smashed by a policeman. We've had people threatened. One of my editors was just saying today that over the weekend she got a call from one of our reporters out in the field, and she was covering a demonstration in Oakland, and they were anarchists, and they were extremely militant, and they got into it, and get out of here, you get out of here, we don't want the press here, and so forth. So she gets this phone call from this woman, and the first thing she hears is, don't you dare bring my mother into this. I'll tell you that right now. So, I mean, it's become kind of a thing, and it isn't helping anyone. I thought, I'm so naive, I thought anarchists were kind of like unicorns. I didn't think they really, you know.
Self-described that.
But you hear them say that they want to dismantle the United States and the system of the monetary system. I mean, to hear somebody actually say that, it just kind of boggles the mind. But they're out there with a hammer and breaking a window. It's just difficult to see.
A hammer to a guy who's trying to break up a demonstration, like a guy
who were the nonviolent demonstrators who were trying to stop the violent ones who then were attacked.
Well, and we do have a story about a guy who staged a terrific demonstration in San Francisco. They laid out on the street. They did outlines on the street. Didn't get a word of coverage hardly, because that same night was the worst night in Oakland when they stopped, blocked the freeway and so forth. He was like, I don't know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't know what to do. You know, what's my alternative?
I did have a good conversation the other day with Ben Jealous, who used to be the head of the NAACP, and this is a story that hopefully will appear in the next day or two. And he says, here's a solution we can have. We need more black prosecutors. You could go into any courthouse, you don't see a lot of black faces as prosecutors. And there's very few black folks in law school. There's maybe 5% of attorneys are black folks. And so he said that would help change the perception, because the DA controls what cases are prosecuted, what are pled out, what aren't, and what are, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there, right now, there's not a diversity of thought there, or of prosecutor there.
Well, I'm friends with the police chief. So, no. But no, here's the thing. I worry about this movement don't ask him. I do worry that, you know, we had Occupy and it was here and it was a big deal and it was very impactful, and then it sort of disappeared because it never coalesced around a certain a mission statement or like a goal that's specific. So if people seem to be coalescing around the ideas of changing the grand jury system, maybe making all police-involved cases go through a preliminary hearing instead of a grand jury system, those kinds of specific ideas that seem to be getting some traction, I think is a good thing. It means that there's really possibility for some actual change. Because if it keeps going this way, there's a group of people alienating everyone, and no one's coalescing around a set of ideas, then it does, you know, run the risk of going by the way of Occupy, which is just sort of to fizzle out. And I think Occupy did some other good things, but I just mean generally as a movement, it didn't live up to its potential, because it never really could come up with a group, you know, a list of specific requirements. I think so many of us who don't go to these events would be supportive of some kind of specific reforms if they were proposed. So it seems to be happening. I hope it continues.
Discussion seems to be happening. Are we seeing any proposed legislation or?
Not legislation just yet. I think they're still ruminating on the ideas of preliminary hearings versus grand juries. Some people want to get rid of grand juries altogether. Some people want to just, you know, recruit, you know, more black prosecutors. And maybe it's a combination of these things. But we're seeing more editorials talking about this, more interviews with protesters talking about this. Instead of just generally, you know, police are bad, you know, the grand jury system needs to be fixed. That's a different statement from somebody who's out protesting than what we saw before. So I think that's a good move.
Well,
and the police cameras, that's the other proposal that's also getting.
And by the way, the police would be as much in favor of that as anyone. I mean,
video. I would watch that channel. If it was just like a channel of like cop lapel pair, I would be like all day. That would be fabulous.
Like cops, next level. Just like, yeah. The show cops. Yeah.
How about just Greg Sir Live? How about that? Let's just do that.
Poker with his friends.
Well, let's move from how the U.S. treats its own people to how the U.S. treats other people. Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, in the waning days of the Democratic Senate majority, got released a report on CIA treatment of detainees. Is that I guess, in the war on terror, so-called. You've all, I'm sure, either seen or have been purposely avoiding the graphic descriptions of what was done, so we won't go into that. But I did want to talk a bit about what this plays out politically. Will this have any impact on change policy? I mean, we're hearing from, you know, folks from the Bush administration, what they're saying. We're hearing, you know, obviously outrage from folks on the left. Joe, I mean, what does it say about, let's actually start with Dianne Feinstein. What does it say about, you know, someone who's in many ways Mrs. Caution?
And also has been, you know, very supportive of the CIA over the years in the intelligence community. She's chair of the intelligence panel there in Washington. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a gutsy move on her part to go against the establishment, to do all that stuff. I think it you know how when Obama ran in 2008, he said, yeah, I'm tired of people reliving the Vietnam War and the battle lines there. I think, you know, if this has any legs politically, we will be replaying the Iraq War and what went into that. I mean, we're still kind of living the Iraq War, so we're not done replaying it, but we're going to replay the early days of it. And we're talking backstage, and Chuck said, you know, if Jeb Bush is running, that's not good for him. I mean, he had nothing, of course, to do with it, but his brother did. And I think that will be part of the calculus there, because, you know, he'll bring back many of the same crew. That's very... would not be surprising at all. And I think that's where it would play out. You know, are you going to bring back the same people who made those decisions in a different administration? And so the thing is, these administrations, you often hire the same folks. You know, Obama hired many of the same folks from the Clinton administration. So, you know, there's kind of a traveling cadre of folks in Washington who have these jobs. So I think that's where it plays out in 2016.
I don't know if it's a change in policy. If you believe the Bush administration, the policy has always been we don't torture. We aren't going to torture. And to then show us what's happened here and say, well, that wasn't torture, that's an embarrassment. Those were enhanced techniques. But, I mean, it's unbelievable. And, I mean, what we need to do is not change the policy. We need to enforce the policy. That is the policy. And this charade that somehow this is getting us valuable information, there was a headline today that said the American people... don't believe that torture works to get information, but they do believe it works on TV. You know, and we see it all the time. You know, Jack Bauer was constantly torturing and getting great information every time it happened. So there is a disconnect. But you know, the policy is we don't torture, and there's no reason for it.
Well, very good, or not very. Whatever. I'm not even going to.
Let's just all walk away
from the torture conversation.
Moving on to another topic. I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking a bit about, you know, each of you. A highlight or two of the past year, politically speaking, you know, significant, whether it was a highlight or a low light. Then we'll take 2015, kind of what you expect to be a major issues of or players in the next year. But maybe starting with you, Joe, what stood out for you in 2014?
Draw down a couple of things. I think one thing that was the Ferguson and Garner decisions and what that conversation that we just kind of had here, and where that's going to go. I'm curious. I think that was a top story this year, and where is that going to go next year? What becomes of it? Does it peter out? Are there going to be changes and reforms? What happened? Republicans taking the Senate and just decisively, not even close. I think that was a message pitch to the president. I think the beheadings of the folks in the Middle East were just very. I was unwatchable, but it also reminded us all that we were still engaged over there in many ways. That war is ongoing. The U.S. and China climate change accord, I thought, was very important. And wow, we're actually working with China on something that's, you know, and for a global issue. We don't know, you know, what's going to be. It might fall short of expectations, but at least it's something. And the torture report. And a couple of things to watch for: what comes of the Ferguson Garner protest, who, if anyone's going to run against Hillary, we talked about that a little earlier, who on the Republican side will emerge, will the Keystone Pipeline be approved? It doesn't sound like, I mean, when Obama was talking to Stephen Colbert the other night, he threw a lot of hints that, no, I don't think I'm going to go for this. But, you know, he seems to be more of his own man the last couple of weeks. So, you know, who knows?
Will Congress be able to do anything? And who will run against Ed Lee?
Melissa, 2014?
My low light of this year and my highlights in the future are related. The low light of this year, of course, is the extremely low voter turnout. I mean, just like shockingly low, right? 42%. I mean, it's bananas. We just blew all the nerds who bet on these, like me, who bet on these kinds of things. Like, just we each lost at least $20. But what's so interesting about that, of course, is that to put things on the ballot, it requires a certain percentage of the people who turned out in the last gubernatorial election. Right? In the state constitution, it says if you want to put a ballot initiative on, the number of signatures you have to collect is based on the turnout. So in the past couple of years, it's been like 800,000 for an initiative based on the Meg Whitman, Jerry Brown election, where we had, you know, some level of turnout. But this election, because only like 7 million people voted in to get something on the ballot in 2016, I did the math here. You don't want to see this. It's really not pretty. But I did the math here. It's to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot is going to take 585,000 signatures. That is 3.2% of registered voters in California can put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. It's going to take even less than that, about 300,000, to put a regular initiative on the ballot. And that's like 2% of registered voters in California. I mean, you guys, it is so ripe right now for, like, rich crazy people, for think tanks, maybe together, I don't know, to put things on the ballot. We're going to see so much interesting stuff. We're probably going to see a marijuana initiative. The same folks who were successful in Colorado are together, and they're trying to put one. They've already registered. They're going to try and do one in California that may be similar. So, you know, ironically, if you think that these thresholds are too low, you need to amend the California Constitution. And now would be a really good time to do it.
Let's do one tonight.
So we could see... Literally, like, fewer, like Justin Bieber has more Twitter followers than this. Like, this is so mind-blowing, the possibilities of all of this. And there are a lot of smart, motivated people who want to do things for California. And there are think tanks and, again, groups of people who really want to do these things. So we can see constitutional amendments, overhauls that we never thought were possible are going to be possible. And also, again, lots of crazy stuff, too. But there's going to be lots of really interesting stuff happening in 2016. Locally, 2015, sheriff election is my favorite thing that's coming. I won't editorialize further than I already have about this, but you've got Vicki Hennessey running against Sheriff Ross Marcorimi. In terms of local elections, right, you have Ed Lee. I mean, I'm not sure how interesting that race is going to get. You know, treasurer, city attorney, district attorney. But this sheriff's race is going to be the really interesting thing. The city finally gets to weigh in on the issue of Ross Marcorimi and his issues with his wife, et cetera. So that's going to be the thing that's going to, I think, dominate so much of the dialogue in 2015. So those are my lowlights and highlights.
So. Well, I'm a Metro columnist, so I write about San Francisco, and I'm going to keep it in San Francisco. And I think one of the really big moments was the defeat of 8 Washington, this development on the waterfront. And one of the things about that was, you know, there was so much talk about Ed Lee and this momentum and how he's got things going his way and the city is changing over to a more moderate stance. He backed that 100%. Gavin Newsom backed that. They had everybody, including me, I was backing it also, and it lost. It lost pretty darn lopsidedly. Now, the turnout wasn't great, but it's a reminder that this is still San Francisco, and we haven't changed completely. It isn't a new world. And with that in mind, what I would watch as the new year comes is what happens with the progressive wing. They're looking for an issue. They've had this issue, the 8 Washington, gave them more hope than they've had in a long time. And it certainly revitalized Art Agnos, who, I don't know where he's been, but, you know, now he's definitely back. So, and if, you know, failing anybody else, who knows, maybe Art Agnos will run against, he may run against it.
Art Agnos, in whose basement Sheriff Marcorimi hung out right for a while.
On his couch, that's right. So it's. I think it's fascinating because it is still very much San Francisco. It's still in flux. It's still in motion. And that was a real wake-up call for a lot of people to realize. I would also add just another thing to watch for. The Warriors coming to San Francisco, kind of mixed feelings. The Oakland crowds have supported them so well.
But it means a lot to a city to have an arena of that size, but it also draws attention to the fact that the whole city is moving in that direction. And that Lennar development down at Hunter's Point, the entire 3rd Street corridor, all those things are changing, and we haven't seen a change like that, a building change like that in San Francisco in decades. So it's a really interesting time, I think, to see politically, economically, and in terms of growth. And, you know, I guess the Warriors are doing okay this year, so...
All good thoughts. One thing I would mention, and this comes from an audience member, but I agree, and this kind of goes back to the Clinton election motto of it's the economy, stupid, and that is just oil prices, question mark. I mean, they are down tremendously. This is having a huge impact internationally. You know, oil last declines. Last time it took big dives, it had major impacts in really geopolitical situation. So, yes. Before we get into a few more questions and then the news quiz, I just have to ask, so who's taking Uber home tonight? Anyone? One, okay. Well, two, okay.
They're off. So you got Lyft, you got Sidecar, you know, if you're politically, you know, preventing them to do it.
Okay, this is a bit of a history question. It's before my time. It might be it's before everyone's time. I just realized I can't. I'll just assume it's before everyone's time. This goes to the issue of the Ferguson and the Eric Garner killings. When a white cop shot a black youth in Hunter's Point in 1966, does anyone know about this case? It said, tell us why riots were contained and peace restored swiftly. This person said the Chamber of Commerce and the Youth for... I'm sorry, I can't read the rest of it. Service played a role in that. Does anyone know anything more about that?
Well, the one thing I'd say is the story, another good story we just had recently is the effect of social media. And one of the things that happens in these disturbances and these demonstrations is everybody is able to coordinate so well. And we're on our way over here, and the cops are over here, and we're going over here, and we're going to go to this. And you've got your message out instantly. And it's a very mobile, active group of demonstrators who are very tough to pin down, as we've seen.
Okay. Who can beat Ed Lee?
Art Agnos.
Oh. Leno was the closest. Mark Leno was like the only one who, where it made, it was kind of, you know, kind of right there. Maybe it was going to be interesting. But right now, polling is showing that no one even comes close. So you might see some, you know, sort of speed bump. Somebody who's just going to be there to kind of drive the debate, yes. Not really, you know, be a legitimate opponent. But yeah, right now there doesn't seem to be anyone.
Next Matt Gonzalez. Who's the next Matt
Gonzalez?
Well,
actually, the first Matt Gonzalez is rumored to be interested in a run, so we're not sure about that. But you know, I don't know if that's been pulled, but he gave a speech the other day, and people thought, oh, well, that looks mayoral candidate-ish of him, so we're not sure. He might.
If he releases a book,
we'll know that something's up if he writes a book.
Okay. Statewide question for governor. Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom?
Well, those two are going to have to get in a room and decide who wants to run for what is what's going to have to happen. Somebody's going to run for Senate and somebody's going to run for governor, and who should it be? And the odd part is Gavin thinks he'd be a great governor, and I think he'd be a much better senator if that's what he's going to do, where he could think deep thoughts and spin things out and go through there. And, you know, that's the guy he is. You know, it's...
4-hour speeches.
Yeah, he's... Yeah, we don't have to do anything. So he can do a state of the country thing in 14 hours again. I think that's they can't knock each other off. That's just silly. So somebody's going to have to say, you guys, you're going to do this. And if it's John Burton or whoever it is, say this is it. Who's a better governor? Nope.
Matt Gonzalez. No. No, here's the thing, and well, one of the other things, if we were looking really, again, ahead to 2016, it's the Barbara Boxer issue, because that's really going to determine sort of, you know, we've got there seems to be kind of an understanding that despite the fact that, like, everybody wants to run for governor and everybody wants to run for Barbara Boxer's seat, that they really are sort of Gavin and Kamala's to kind of divvy up between themselves. So assuming Barbara Boxer does not run for re-election, and we'll know soon, she said she's going to tell us in early next year, then we'll know kind of who's calling dibs on what, although I would give anything to be at that meeting where they sit down and, like, you know, rock, paper, scissors each other. for the seat. Because I think, to your point, I mean, people on either side have made good arguments that Kamala would be a better senator versus governor, and that, you know, Gavin Newsom the same.
I have always gone with the Kamala would be a better governor because she heads a state bureaucracy. It's 4,000 people. Then again, Gavin did run a city bureaucracy that was, you know, sizable, but not that big, I don't think. But lately, I'm thinking there's a, you know, when Boxer and Feinstein were first elected in 1992, year of the woman, maybe the feeling might be, let's have a woman of color in the Senate. Those are few and far between, so maybe that might be the thinking. Who knows?
One last one, and we'll go national for this one. Jeb Bush released 250,000 emails. Will Hillary do the same? Should she? Will she? Does anyone want to read them?
I do. Don't you? Don't you want to see Hillary be like, LOL, you know? Check out this YouTube cat video, you know? I would love that.
Bill,
what is she
sending
people?
Crazy.
What is she? I would love to know that. Yeah. I would love to have someone summarize them for me, actually. It's kind of probably what I should say about that.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our news quiz. And if Fran is here and could come up, she's going to be our prize distributor. Fran's coming up. Now, the way this works is I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. The raising of the hand is important here. Those of you who were here last time might remember. Raise your hand, I'll call on you, shout out the answer, and if you're right, Fran will deliver a nice little chocolate treat to you. So let's start. Who claimed responsibility for hanging black effigies around the UC Berkeley campus? Have you seen this story? Yes. That's right. A woman over there was an anonymous artist activist group. Yes. That's about as specific as they were, too. Okay, former presidential candidate John McCain has stood out as a lone Republican supporting what action by Senator Dianne Feinstein? I saw your hand first. The release of the torture report, that's correct. So Fran right here in the cool red sweater.
I think you get at least half of those chocolates. You helped quite a bit on that.
You have no idea how many chocolates I have up in my office. So, regarding this CIA torture report, who said, quote, I would do it again in a minute? Sir? Dick Cheney, former vice president. Right here in the blue shirt.
Ruffle through the crowd.
This is the mention of Dick Cheney's name.
That's actually not Cheney sounds. That's kind
that
of
a Cheney impression
there.
Who said he expects black media to report allegations about him with a, quote, neutral mind? Ma'am, I saw your hand first. Yes. Bill Cosby, that's correct. See her, raise your hand again so Frank can see you. We'll see if you've caught this story. Due to objections to the Orthodox Church there, what fan project was halted in Moscow? Oh, come on. Fan project. It was a project designed by fans of a very, I'll give you a hint, a very well-known movie and TV series. Way in the back.
The Eye of Sauron.
That's right. They were going to build the Eye of Sauron from The Lord of the Rings on top of a Moscow skyscraper, and the Russian Orthodox Church said no. Okay. So I think it would be cool if they did it here, frankly. They should do that here. Anyway, maybe not. Who said this week that the presidential campaign is not an IQ test? Ma'am, in the front. Rick Perry, Texas governor. As they say in journalism, no comment. Sweden said a plane from what country nearly hit an airliner near its border? Way in back there?
Russia,
that's correct. Fran, do you see? Okay. And I think we have, let's do one more. I actually write a bunch of questions, and occasionally they answer them already during the thing. So let's say...
Shall we get chocolate?
No. you get the fame. That's better than chocolate. That's got to be a good quote. I answered that one earlier. So Lakers star Kobe Bryant surpassed the point-scoring total held by whom? And sir, way in back in the blue. Michael Jordan. That's right. Okay, folks, we will have more news quiz questions, another social, and, of course, much more to discuss on Wednesday, January 14th, at our next week-to-week political roundtable right here at the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you to our panel, Joe Garofoli, Melissa Griffin-Kane, the Melissa Griffin-Kane, and Chuck Mevious. Thanks to all of you here in the Commonwealth Club, everyone listening online and watching on TV. Have a great week and a wonderful holiday season.